Order, order.
The House resumes at 2 on Tuesday, back from a week's adjournment to start a three-week sitting period running through to Thursday, November the 17th. Question time on Tuesday will be followed, provided there's no successful application for an urgent debate, by the government putting the House to work on its legislation. Although the Leader of the House, Jerry Brownlee, wasn't giving much away on what will be on the order papers this week when he delivered his business statement before the start of the adjournment.
The Honourable Jerry Brownlee.
Mr Speaker, when the House resumes on Tuesday the 1st of November, the government will look to complete the third readings of the 8 bills which have been split from the Health Practitioners Replacement of Statutory References to Medical Practitioners Bill and a number of other bills on the order paper.
There was just enough time before the adjournment on Thursday evening for the House to make a start on that medical practitioners bill in the name of the Minister of Health, Jonathan Coleman, who launched the debate on its third and final reading.
This bill will amend 8 acts to remove references to medical practitioner and replace them with the words health practitioner. That's going to enable a wider range of suitable health practitioners to undertake certain functions that are currently restricted only to medical practitioners.
Many health professional groups were now capable of performing the tasks that were previously the sole domain of medical practitioners, such as the minister, before he left medicine behind for a career in politics.
The purpose of this bill is to improve access to services for New Zealanders, and this government wants to ensure that people receive timely care from the most appropriate health practitioner close to home. And that's going to be a very necessary approach if we are going to have a sustainable health system that can provide the services that everyone across the country needs in the long term.
Jonathan Coleman was followed in the debate by his chief critic, Labour spokeswoman on health.
The Honourable Annette King.
Thank you, Mr Speaker. And Labour, as they have throughout this bill, supported at its third reading. I want to begin by saying I would have thought the Minister could have shown a little bit more enthusiasm about this bill, because certainly the Health Select Committee did not. We did not find it boring at all. In fact, I want to begin by saying that the Health Committee took the bill very seriously. We did a very good job on the bill and have reported it back once we got our hands on it.
Mrs King was pleased the bill was near the end of what she described as a very long process, and she praised the Health Select Committee and its chairman.
I do think we have an extremely good health committee, and I will say of Simon O'Connor, one of the best chairs we've had of a select committee, and I think he should be in cabinet. In fact, he'd probably make an extremely good health minister. He's informed, he is informed, he's reasoned, he knows a little bit about it, and he's interested, and none of those qualities our current minister has.
And with perfect timing, Annette King was followed in the debate by Simon O'Connor.
Look, thank you to the member who's just resumed her seat for the very kind words. It is a death knell for my career to have the opposition laud me so strongly. It's been an absolute pleasure to serve this House, and this could become a valedictory.
National Simon O'Connor, who chairs the Health Select Committee, which split into two subcommittees to travel to Christchurch on Friday to hear more submissions on its inquiry into the public's view of medically assisted death, which was prompted by a petition from former Labour MP Marianne Street and nearly 9,000 others. The only other Select Committee this week was not open to the public. The Marie Affairs Committee gathered behind closed doors here at Parliament on Wednesday for an all-day meeting to discuss a bill that's dividing the House right down the middle. Tatura Whenua Māori Bill has a backstory that begins in the 1860s in the first legislation affecting Māori land. Widespread frustration among Māori at the laws coming out of colonial parliaments eventually culminated in Dame Whenua Cooper's Māori Land March in 1975 and the Bulger National Government's response in Tatura Whenua Māori Act of 1993, a very significant piece of legislation in the view of the current Minister for Māori Development, Te Uaroa Flavel.
The Tatura Whenua Māori Act 1993 was arguably one of the most groundbreaking pieces of legislation of our generation because of the seismic shift it made in Māori land policy.
Te Uaroa Flavel there in the House on May the 10th this year, launching the first reading debate on his Tatura Whenua Māori Bill, which amends the 1993 Act.
This bill we're considering today, Mr Speaker, is one of the most important measures for Māori that this Parliament will consider in our time, and I am proud and humbled to be the steward of it into the House this afternoon.
The Minister of Māori Development then looked back at the bill's origins.
It was the 1975 land march that completely changed the legal framework for Māori land. It shifted from one that assimilated and alienated Māori land to one that promoted retention.
But Te Tūra Whenua Māori Act was far from perfect.
We know that because the first attempt to reform it started in 1998, 5 years later. And there have been at least six panels to consider the changes over time.
In the last 4 years alone, a panel was established in 2012 by the Associate Minister for Māori Affairs, the Attorney-General, Christopher Finlayson, to review the 1993 Act. The panel took nearly 2 years to publish its report in April 2014. Then, the following February, Mr. Flavel formed a second advisory group. A new consultation document and draft bill came out in May, and in June, a ministerial advisory group held 23 consultation hearings attended by well over 1,000 people. Then in March this year, the Waitangi Tribunal released a full report on the bill, as it was at the time, saying that Māori would be prejudiced if it went ahead in its current form. More on that from Rhys Lyon, following this final argument from Te Uruwa Flavel.
The purpose of this bill is to recognise and provide for the mana and tino rangatiratanga that since time immemorial, Māori have exercised and continue to exercise over their lands, resources and taonga in accordance with tikanga Māori, and consistent with the guarantees given to Māori and Te Tiriti o Waitangi to protect the rights of owners of Māori land to retain, control, occupy and develop their land as a taonga tuku iho for the benefit of present and future generations of owners, their whānau and their hapū. If we can achieve this purpose, Mr. Speaker, then we will unquestionably be one of the most important measures this Parliament will consider for Māori in our time.
Māori Development Minister Te Uruwa Flavel in the first reading debate of his Te Tūra Whenua Māori Bill on May the 10th. But the bill faces stern opposition, as Rhys Lyon discovered.
Leading Labour's opposition to the bill, its Ikaroa Rāwhiti MP, Mika Whaitere, questioned the stated rationale for the Te Tūra Whenua Māori Bill.
The Crown asserts the current Act constraints have led to the underperformance of up to 80% of Māori land and believes new legislation will unlock hundreds of millions of dollars in returns for owners. This is exceptionally misleading. Under the Act, many Māori entities are thriving economically. Wepere Trust, Mangatuan Corporation in my electorate of Ikaroa Rāwhiti and Tuarapaki Trust in the Minister's own electorate of Wairiki are some fine examples of economic success under the Act.
Mika Whaitere said the proposed bill was in breach of the principles of the Treaty of Waitangi.
The Treaty of Waitangi principle requires effective protection mechanisms and properly informed broad-based support of Māori. This bill, sir, I believe, has not fulfilled either of these requirements. After over a century of struggling with the effects of bad legislation that disadvantaged Māori and led to the massive loss of land, a hard-won Crown Māori consensus informed by the 1975 land march led by Dame Whena Cooper, with a catch cry of not one more acre, resulted in our current law, Te Tūru Whenua Māori Act 1993.
Ms. Whaitere said that Act had been thoroughly consulted when it was first passed.
The current Act took more than 10 years to pass through the various stages of lawmaking. This shows the consideration required when attempting major changes to the relationship between Māori and their whenua. The New Zealand Māori Council, the Māori Women's Welfare League, were active political watchdogs of successive governments, and the Law Commission also played a significant role.
The Labour MP suggested the same level of consultation hadn't been followed this time around, as evidenced by a finding issued by the Waitangi Tribunal after it received complaints about the process taken in reviewing the original Act.
The Waitangi Tribunal, sir, found that the reforms have not been progressed without sufficient empirical research, meaning the Crown and Māori cannot be fully informed on the rationale for changes, nor the implications arising from some changes proposed. The Waitangi Tribunal, sir, further states that reforming this legislation without genuine consultation and broad-based support from Māori would be a breach of the Treaty of Waitangi. The Waitangi Tribunal declared the consultation hui in June 2015 breached legal standards. I attended many of the hui, including over half of the 21 hui hastily organised this February. Many attendees, sir, were at a loss at these hui as to why so little time was given to absorb the details and implications of the bill. The Minister heard it for himself. By introducing the bill to Parliament, the Crown has failed to ensure fair and valid consultation processes.
Mika Whaitiri criticised the government over the number of changes it had made to the bill in light of the Waitangi Tribunal's full report on it.
With over 110 changes made to the bill since the exposure draft was first published in 2015, Te Tūru Whenua Māori Bill represents policy made on the fly. A key issue is whether reforms can be effective when the bill has been subjected to such ongoing unplanned changes. Creating policy and legislative settings off the cuff is high risk, and it is concerning that it took a tribunal hearing to prompt further revisions to the bill from the Minister's officials. The reforms now present as legislation being written on the go without clear analysis of impacts.
Ms Whaitiri was particularly concerned about an erosion of powers of the Māori Land Court and questioned the reasoning behind the move.
Because there has been no extensive research on the existing Act, it is impossible to say whether removal of the Māori Land Court's protective role will help good governance of land. In my view, the proposed changes to the role of the court are high risk. In the bill, engaged owners will be able to represent the interests of all owners for certain decisions rather than the Māori Land Court making such determinations.
The bill originally shifted decision-making power from the Māori Land Court to new governance structures called rangatōpū, a proposal that has now been made optional.
One of the many off-the-cuff changes made to the bill, there is no longer a quality safeguard in place. This means if related parties, the engaged owners, were making decisions on behalf of others, then they will be doing so with no set framework or quality standard of governance.
Ms Whaitiri was also sceptical of the bill's establishment of a Māori land service, which the Minister, Te Aroa Whewhu, says is intended to support Māori landowners in all of their land matters so they can achieve their aspirations.
It is unfortunate that Māori landowners have not been given sufficient information of how the service will run, where it will be based, and more importantly, what its role would actually be. It is not enough to say this work is in progress, given the expectation that succession and land development services will be provided by this yet-to-be-established service.
Ms Whaitiri said her party would not support the bill.
There is a lack of rationale for the reforms and no way of ensuring legislative solutions, sir, are fit for purpose. So, sir, this is why Labor is not supporting the bill.
Labor's Mika Whaitiri, whose party was joined by the Greens and New Zealand First in opposition to the bill, their combined tally of 58 votes defeated by the 63 of National, the Māori Party, ACT and United Future. The bill is due to be reported back from the Māori Affairs Committee by November the 25th.
That report from Reece Lyon. Submissions on that Te Tūru Whenua Māori bill have closed. But if you're really busting to make a submission, why not put one in on the review of standing orders, which are open till Friday, November the 25th, or on the Outer Space and High Altitude Activities Bill, which is open for submissions until Thursday, December the 1st, and is still on the Watch the Space, so to speak. For more details on how to make a submission and who to make it to, go to www.parliament.nz and click the Have Your Say button. The Health Committee will be hearing more submissions on this inquiry into public attitudes on assisted dying. That's on Wednesday morning, but only for an hour between 10 and 11. They'll be in Room 2 in Bowen House, while over in the main building, the Māori Affairs Committee will be closing the doors of Room 6 to spend another 3 hours huddled over Te Tūru Whenua Māori Bill. On Tuesday, the week in the House began with the sad news from the Speaker, David Carter.
Honourable members, I regret to inform the House of the death on the 30th of October 2016 of Reginald George Borman, who represented the Wairarapa electorate from 1984 to 1988. I desire on behalf of this House to express our sense of the loss we have sustained and our sympathy with the relatives of the late former member. I now ask members to stand with me and observe a period of silence as a mark of respect for his memory.
Labor's Reg Borman defeated National Cabinet Minister Ben Couch to win the Wairarapa seat in 1984. National won the seat back in 1987 when it was taken by Wyatt Creech after an appeal to the Electoral Court. Mr. Borman died on Sunday at the age of 81. After members stood for a minute in his memory, the Speaker heard this request from the Greens Foreign Affairs spokesman, Kennedy Graham.
Mr. Speaker, I seek leave to move a motion without notice or debate that the House welcomes the recent UN resolution calling for negotiations on a treaty to prohibit nuclear weapons.
Is there any objection to that course of action being followed?
There is none. Dr. Kennedy Graham.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I move that this House welcomes the landmark UN First Committee resolution on October 27, calling for negotiations to commence on a legally binding instrument that will prohibit nuclear weapons, leading to their elimination, and calls upon all nuclear weapon states to participate constructively in the negotiations that are expected to commence in March 2017.
The question is that that motion be agreed to. Those of that opinion will say aye.
Aye.
To the contrary, no. The ayes have it.
Then it was on to the first of the daily dozen questions for ministers.
The House comes to questions for oral answer. Question number one, in the name of David Seymour.
Mr. Speaker, my question is to the Minister of Police and reads as follows. Does she believe the public has a right to be concerned about police conducting roadside breath screening tests with the intention of collecting personal information for investigations unrelated to road safety? And if not, why not?
The Honourable Judith Collins.
Mr. Speaker, while there is no ministerial responsibility for the genuinely held views of members of the New Zealand public, and both Section 16 of the Policing Act 2008 and the Cabinet Manual preclude my intervention in particular policing operations, I can confirm that the Commissioner of Police has referred this incident to the Independent Police Conduct Authority for investigation.
Supplementary.
Supplementary question, David Seymour.
Does the Minister believe it is a good use of police resources to interrogate law-abiding people attending a peaceful meeting of an advocacy group, given an 18% spike in burglary reported by Statistics New Zealand just this week?
The Honourable Judith Collins.
Mr. Speaker, I think I've answered that question very clearly. This is not a matter that I can comment on. It's currently with the Independent Police Conduct Authority, and for me to make a statement about that or have any sort of view would in fact actually try to influence the IPCA, and this is not a Labor government, this is a national government.
Order. Question number two. Supplementary question, David Seymour.
Can the Minister comment on whether she is completely satisfied with how police currently allocate their resources, given increases in assault, sexual assault, abduction, kidnapping, robbery and extortion, but no reported increases in rogue advocacy groups in Mangaraki?
The Honourable Judith Collins.
Well, Mr. Speaker, clearly the member isn't aware that road policing is actually funded out of the Ministry of Transport, not out of police.
True.
Order. Supplementary question, David Seymour.
Does the Minister agree with Privacy Commissioner John Edwards when he says there would be pretty troubling aspects, in quote, to an operation that used the statutory power and indeed funding provided under the Land Transport Act to gather personal information for a different purpose?
The Honourable Judith
Collins. Well, Mr. Speaker, I'm not sure how many times I need to tell that member that I have no intention of wading into an investigation that the Independent Police Conduct Authority is undertaking. I take my responsibilities very seriously, and I also would refer the member to not only the Policing Act 2008, Section 16, but also the Cabinet Manual on this issue.
Supplementary.
Order. Supplementary question, David Seymour.
Does the Minister have any views about how a police force should operate and how it should allocate its resources?
The Honourable Judith Collins.
Yes, I do. And one of the ways I believe that police should operate is not to have politicians telling them how to do their job.
Order. Order. David Seymour, supplementary question.
Will she guarantee that someone will eventually be held accountable for this gross breach of civil liberties?
The Honourable Judith Collins.
Well, Mr Speaker, I think the member's jumping to conclusions. I suggest he leave it to the Independent Police Conduct Authority, which is the right and proper place and people to look into this issue.
Supplementary.
The member has used his allocation. Oh. Question number two, Dr Parmjeet Palmer.
Thank you, Mr Speaker. My question is to the Minister of Finance. What reports has he received on the performance of the New Zealand economy?
The Honourable Stephen Joyce.
Mr Speaker, on behalf of the Minister of Finance, last week the World Bank released their annual Doing Business report. The 2017 report shows that for the first time, New Zealand has been ranked first in the world for the ease of doing business, up one place from last year and up from third in 2014. The report is made up of 10 different indicators that affect the conduct of a business. New Zealand ranks first in the world in half of these, including starting a business, dealing with construction permits, registering property, getting credit and protecting minority investors. This is an excellent result and highlights the good work government agencies are doing through our comprehensive business growth agenda to reduce the cost of doing business and grow jobs in New Zealand.
Supplementary, Mr Speaker.
Supplementary question, Dr Parmjeet Palmer.
What else is the government doing to make it easier to do business in New Zealand?
The Honourable Stephen Joyce.
Mr Speaker, on behalf of the Minister of Finance, the government's comprehensive business growth agenda creates an environment where businesses have the confidence to invest and grow. It contains more than 300 separate initiatives, including building better infrastructure, like roads of national significance and ultra-fast broadband, encouraging domestic and foreign investment in the economy, more highly skilled New Zealanders to contribute to our growth, encouraging research and development, developing our significant natural resources while protecting our environment, and improving access to markets offshore through free trade agreements and reducing non-tariff trade barriers. Mr Speaker, there's always room to improve further, and the government will continue to work hard to make it easier to do business.
Mr Speaker.
Supplementary question, Dr Parmjeet Palmer.
Thank you, Mr Speaker. What reports has he received showing support amongst small businesses for the government's economic programme?
The Honourable Stephen Joyce.
Well, Mr Speaker, on behalf of the Minister of Finance, very important, of course, small businesses, because they are a big part of our economy. I've received a report titled Small Businesses Signal Election Priorities from MYOB. MYOB's report found that 42% of the businesses surveyed, over 1,000, expect revenues to increase in the next year, with just 11% expecting a fall, reflecting the benefits of a growing economy. MYOB goes on to say, and I quote, "People do trust John Key and Bill English's economic management. There is a strong sense in the small business community that the country is on the right track." Right. Mr Speaker, the World Bank's Doing Business report underlines that small businesses have confidence in the direction of this government.
Order. Order. There's been quite a lot of interjection this afternoon, and a reasonable amount I'll accept, but when it becomes a barrage that I can't hear the balance of the answer, then I will deal with it more severely. Does the Minister wish to complete his answer? Question number three, Andrew Little.
Thank you, Mr Speaker. My question is to the Prime Minister. Does he have confidence in the Minister of Police, given crime rose by 5.5% in the last year?
Speaker.
The Right Honourable Prime Minister.
Speaker, absolutely, because crime rates have fallen significantly over the term of this National Lead government.
Supplementary.
Supplementary question, Andrew Little.
Why have burglaries gone up 7.8% and assaults gone up 9% in the past year alone?
The Speaker, Right Honourable Prime Minister.
Speaker, I can't give you the exact answer to that because I don't know all of the reasons, but in some cases it will be more widespread use of drugs and some people feeding their drugs habit. There'll be one reason, there'll be many reasons. So.
Supplementary.
Supplementary question, Andrew Little.
Does he think burglaries going up 7.8% and assaults going up 9% has anything to do with the fact that he's failed to increase police numbers in line with a rising population?
They're arresting more people.
The Right Honourable Prime Minister.
Speaker, no, there are a variety of different reasons. I mean, one of them is that, for instance, when it comes to domestic violence, that has become a topic which is now more widely debated, exposed, and there's more reporting going on of domestic violence. So, Mr Speaker, no, I don't think that's the case. This is a government that put $300 million more into police budgets just in 2016 alone. The annual budget's gone from $1.2 billion to $1.6 billion. There are hundreds more extra police under a national-led government and greater use of technology.
Supplementary.
Supplementary question, Andrew Little.
Why has he broken his 2007 promise, which went like this? He promised to, quotes, improve the ratio of police to population beyond 1 to 500 from 2009.
Well, Mr. Speaker, we have substantially increased the number of police. Mr Speaker, one of the things that we've been looking at in the time that we've been in government is to say that, one way of measuring the number of police is to look at it on a ratio basis, but actually I think there's also other ways of looking at it more effectively. For instance, you know, when we look at the use of technology, which I think is a far better investment in a lot of ways, we've effectively gained 354 extra police. Now, you can put all of those things in the budget, but it is really sort of a sort of slightly lazy way of thinking things, just to dream up a number on the day of a police conference and claim that's a policy. You know, it's not really a policy, is it?
Supplementary.
Order.
Oh, spin master.
Order. Supplementary question, Andrew Little.
Why, when he promised in 2007 to have a 1 to 500 police ratio, does he not have a 1 to 500 police ratio 8 years on?
Mr Speaker,
the Right Honourable Prime Minister.
As I said, well, firstly, we've been investing considerably more. Secondly, there are different ways of measuring these things. Yes, the policies that we take into the 2008 election were quite a number of elections ago, but over time, Mr Speaker, you know, the government not only is investing more, but of course is looking at ways that we will continue to invest more, but just dreaming up a number, as the member did. The reason that he got coverage on page A7 or A9 of the Herald that was about this big was because no one actually believes he's going to be in a position to do it anyway.
Supplementary.
What an arrogant Prime Minister.
Order.
Arrogant.
Order. Supplementary question.
Thank you, Mr Speaker. Why has he spread the police so thin that almost 60% of police officers say they can't deliver on the promises they make to the public?
The Right Honourable Prime Minister.
Mr Speaker, I'm sure the police will always argue that they need more resources, but that's equally true of every publicly funded institution. They will always argue that they need more. Under this national-led government, there have not only been 600 more police, but there's been 354 additional extra police in the sense of the technology that we have rolled out has allowed them to do that. The government is funding more for police resources and over time will give them more. But, Mr Speaker, I don't actually accept the argument that the police are under-resourced. I accept the argument that over time they can do with more, but they've had significant increases in the time we've been in the government.
Supplementary.
Supplementary question, Andrew Little.
Why has his government lost control of crime, as it has on housing, health, education, immigration, traffic congestion, and when will he admit he is out of touch and out of ideas?
The Right Honourable Prime Minister.
Mr Speaker, if one looks at total crime in New Zealand since 2011, it's down 15%. Except in the last year, it's up 1.4%. There's also been an international trend, Mr Speaker, where both in OECD countries, crime has gone down a bit and crime has risen a bit. But overall, it's down 15%, which is actually pretty similar to Labor's polling since 2008 to now. It's down about 15%.
The Prime Minister, John Key, never wasting a chance to score a political point. I'm Tom Frewin, and this programme was made with funding from Parliament.